Cape Town radio, which is a telecom agency that takes the emergency call. was also previously part of the medical practice that field is very, very good advice to ship to sea and actually makes the decision then whether the crew member needs to come off the vessel or not, in other words, whether it's an emergency. There's a standard text that's sent to the MRCC for them to be able to evaluate the case, and then they recommend evacuation. And then the MRC activates the evacuation, and that happens either by boat, in this case the NSRI does it with the small flight fleet, or it's done by helicopter, and essentially either that's the South African Air Force, and that's what I'm talking about, or it's a private operator. Now, unfortunately, the private operators generally charge about 200,000 rand for one medevac. It depends how many aircraft they fly. If they had to fly a long distance of two aircraft, that cost would double. So it's a very expensive operation by air through a private operator. Obviously, our legislative mandate comes through the SATCOL Act, so we are a sub rescue center, rescue coordinating center for the Department of Transport, and our station commanders manage these medevacs at a local level. But at the top level, obviously, the Maritime Rescue Coordinating Centre management is we have, apart from the boat crew, we have crew that are trained as rescue swimmers to staff helicopters. The medical crew on helicopters normally come from emergency medical services in the provinces along the coast. So the paramedics and doctors that could go out on that helicopter would be from those services. Okay, so I've alluded to the 70 or so more evacuations. These are just some illustrations of the kind of environment so that you can appreciate the context of these rescues. That was the first one that gives you an idea of the risk and the altitude. Those are hemp ladders, pilot ladders that you have to climb up. It's very slippery, it's very dangerous. As we see, the gangplank can come down the boat with the crew members. Some of these operations are done at night, which adds another element of risk. Sometimes there's a crane, a container vessel often is a small crane which makes it a little bit safer, can lower the patient down. But there are many safety issues in this for our volunteer crews. And as I say, this meeting and presentation has been stimulated by the fact that one of our crew members came very close to dying in one of these incidents, and I can't allow that to happen. So the pitfalls, in summary, of these evacuations are that it's a mobile environment, there are two ships moving in different directions, and to get the crew up and the patient down is difficult. There's a risk to the boat. There are instances where the PE boat is nearly stuck under the rear end of the tanker in ballast and into the propeller, and the coxswain manages to get that vessel up at the last minute and save the boat and the crew. There's obviously a risk to the crew, to the patient that we rescue. Obviously, the inexperienced medical personnel that are occasionally deployed in this environment, there is a risk that they're not trained to climb those ladders and to do this. There's obviously a risk of a patient falling into the water, and then you need equipment and things that's appropriate to the task, which is very expensive. So I've alluded to the two safety incidents and given you those examples now. The last one nearly resulted in a serious injury to the crew member. We've made several recommendations. Some of them are in relation to the boat evacuation, and I'll talk to the helicopter evacuation, but we've gone to quite a lot of trouble with some assistance from the LOTO to fund very expensive stretcher that's a bound bag. It's a 27,000 rand stretcher with all the low access equipment and specialist equipment to try and make this safer by boat, but it's not. It's always going to be a very risky procedure, and the ideal solution would be to do these medevacs by helicopter. So our solution, my suggestion is that there are at least four helicopter stations that have medium to long range, and if you go more than 50 nautical miles out to sea, two aircraft have to fly in case one ditches, and then the second one rescues the crew in the first helicopter. So if you fly longer distance over sea, you have to have two helicopters. There aren't private services along the coast to be able to provide that capacity. The only possible service that could provide that capacity is the South African Air Force. And there are issues at the moment that, which is why I'm here to address. So the first prize would be the South African Air Force. They have a national network of helicopters along the coast. They have squadrons along the coast. And I'll put that in some detail. There are a lot of issues that go with this. It's not only about the medevac and the rescue. Obviously, there's a 4-to-1 training ratio that needs to take place. Both the crews, pilots, the medical crew, and everybody have to participate in training. These aircraft have to be licensed correctly, they have to have a medical configuration and equipment to be able to do these rescues, they have to have an operable winch. These are all things that need to be solved in this environment. idea of cost, and this is a cost based on an hourly fuel consumption of a Super Puma helicopter, which is very similar to the Oryx helicopter that the South African Airport used. Probably to comply with the training requirements and for the execute those operations, probably about 12 million rand in assisting fuel. So the problem, one of the issues, and I've already said that South African Air Force would be the ideal solution for this, is that there are problems with the South African Air Force at the moment. They do not have the operations capacity to be able to do these rescues, and that's why I think there needs to be a conversation between the two departments to try and facilitate that the South African Air Force develop the capacity in terms of aircraft and personnel to be able to do these operations with a low threshold of ask. In other words, often they check whether this is a genuine emergency before you go. But the truth is, you only know once you get on the ship what the state of that patient is. So you need quite a low threshold to fly. Otherwise, we'll be going up by boat, you know, and then having to send an aircraft later. So these are the issues with the South African Air Force. I'm not going to go through them in some detail, just to say that there are serious capacity issues. I think maybe just to highlight that there is only one South African Air Force pilot in South Africa on the South African coastline at the moment that is licensed to land on a vessel at sea. Now, I think that just underlines the capacity that's absent in this environment from South African Air Force point of view. And I think something seriously and urgently needs to be done about that to resolve the issue. And I think that can only be resolved through facilitation between the two departments and hopefully help the South African Air Force develop this capacity. I understand it's not within the direct area of responsibility of the Department of Transport, but I think because the rescue lies in the Department of Transport, a conversation with the Department of Defense is necessary to circle that. So, in summary, then, we're a maritime nation. We have an international responsibility in terms of an international treaty to provide helicopter rescue or helicopter medical evacuation of patients at sea. We have 12,000 ships visiting our coast every year and docking in South African harbors. Helicopter evacuation of patients by air is far safer than by boat, and I've illustrated that through the examples and the nervousness that we've had in relation to modern jet crews. I certainly think the cost in relation to this is certainly affordable. It's not a huge cost, and I think the South African Air Force will be the best provider given the issues that I've raised. And that's it. Thank you very much. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
probably assist in terms of gathering of information and other related matters. Honorable members, the mayor, Honorable Kuisinga, Honorable Hadere, Honorable Pitaita, Honorable Teko.
It's quite clear from the presentation that we are way under staff and way under equipment. You suggested agreements with the imports. Just the one factor is the statement that you made that we are only having one full-time pilot. So can you elaborate on a visualized step-by-step way to go? Obviously, if we only had one trained pilot, the concern is who would train these needed pilots? Would they be able to train locally? How long would such a training take? Because it's more than just a matter of purchasing a couple of choppers. They need to be equipped in a very special way. That way of equipping, would that cause that you would have dedicated helicopters? Would those helicopters be able to be used for different circumstances? If you could just give us a more practical line out of what is needed to rectify the situation. And then from the amount of traffic that you mentioned, in terms of 20,000 or 12,000 ships passing our coastline, what would the ideal ratio be in terms of international standards? Because the underlying concern is that we are signatories to international agreements and therefore we hold responsibility for these ships that pass our coast. So what would the ideal ratio be in terms of being equipped in accordance with international standards?
My question is, I think in relation to the issue of the issue of capacity, to also check what the good doctors, maybe try to engage with other institutions that provide training in terms of maybe institutions that probably you work and resume. But I think the other thing that is important is to understand the headwork that you also can manage. It's very much important that you are safe. And I'm trying also to check in terms of how many functions do you have that are you making these actions of. But there's very much that I am trying to understand what is going to be done by yourself or by the any other satellite institutions. But also you say, the idea that you need around about 4 helicopters. I'm trying to check in terms of the bank hatch, because the helicopter is probably, operates normally. I don't have a problem, then what do you do, which becomes also a challenge. this is very much an intense project issue. But as well, how long do you expect probably to get a proper response to this attack? Because I think it will be in particular for the committee. I don't engage, you don't just engage on the Department of Defense, but you also engage the treasure. Because I think this will need lots of resources. So I think this we can be able to explain ourselves so that we can also put in some more effort energy to make sure that it is this delivery of the difference. That's it.
The doctor's sort of like this
the second question, as far as your relationship with the state or the country, and whatever your answer is, have the relevant parties been advised thereof, and what is their reaction? Then, the slide that you said discussion with SAAF is not in our handouts. It would be interesting just to get that. But what has been your interaction with the AAFs and their reaction? And have you also thought about using the Conference on Defense, which I'm covering at what we're doing today? And there's a great concern that you tell us that there's only one master's card in NC. Why is this a situation? Why is this allowed to happen? I remember previously we had a great question in this regard. What's happened in the meantime? Something must have happened, but it's not to be true to God. That's it.
You know, the
second
question for the presentation.
In their presentation, it was mentioned that the NGO, the non-profit making organization, is working with the Department of Social Development. Am I correct? Who else is playing a role? I was thinking of the Department of Health, since you are saying you are providing the medical rescue, whatever. Who else is in that space? And also, what has kept you going for all the years that you are there? And also that if you are working there in the sea, who else are you seeing there? Are you the only organization that is there, or are there other organizations that are also occupying that space? And also, according to your recommendations, the challenges that you have mentioned, is there a risk? Was there any loss of life, whatever? What problems do you encounter with regards to the ships that do not fly their country's flag? Is it not difficult for you to trace since you are doing this rescue exercise to trace the origins of those patients? Is the shortage of helicopter and training of staff the only challenge that you are coming up with? We are here today with the Department of Transport. Where will you be tomorrow? Which other departments or whatever do you think of or touching? I think that's far that I can go. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think I'm
going to
have down the on my left. Thank you very much, Dr.
Roger. Thank you very much, Dan. In terms of the South Airport infrastructure, my understanding is that they have helicopters, that they have the maintenance contract.
For the record, it's in discussion.
So the South African Air Force, my understanding, has aircraft, but the maintenance contract necessary to maintain those aircraft haven't been maintained. So the contracts have lapsed. And there are no contracts. I understand that there are Orange helicopters, which is a similar helicopter to the Super Puma standing in hangars, that could be maintained, but there's nothing. In terms of the crew, I understand that it's not only pilots, it's engineering crew, it's maintenance staff for those aircraft, and it's the engineers that fly on the aircraft that operate the winches and do other tasks on the aircraft. So it's the whole crew's training. And I think that there has been a decline in the capacity and numbers of trained crew pilots and engineers in the Air Force for some time, and I think that capacity needs to be put back. And I think I think the personnel side of it is a major issue in this country. In terms of normative models for international best practice, I'm not aware that there's a particular ratio between shipping traffic and helicopters overseas. Just to say that certainly in Europe, you know, they would, all those European countries would have helicopter medevac services. So, and around the world it would be a standard that you would have a helicopter service able to do medevac services. So a lot of those are military operations, so because of the particular requirements and the requirements for aircraft that can fly long distances, 150 nautical miles out to sea, FTA chapter, and I think there's a, you know, there's a normal practice around the world. In terms of the question as to, you know, the training requirements for doctors and new staff is aircraft. Obviously, the crews would be provided by the aircraft operator out of the South African Air Force or private provider. They are private providers. The Request Emergency Service runs a fleet of Augusta 119 helicopters along the coast, particularly in KwaZulu-Natal and in Western Cape. It doesn't have aircraft in Eastern Cape. But those are not aircraft that can fly underneath the North Kumasi. It's a small aircraft that can reach a single base. You can't land on it. There's a single engine, and therefore in the oil and gas industry, with a single engine aircraft, you can't land on, which is another problem. So they generally do coastal rescue, inshore rescue, wilderness search and rescue, mountain rescue along the coast. They don't do offshore rescue to tankers and container rescue. Then the other part of the crew that needs to be trained are obviously the rescue swimmers, which we provide as an NPO. So if somebody does end up in the water, we can put a crew member into the water to rescue that person that's fallen in, or it might be the patient. The paramedics and the medical staff come normally from government emergency medical services, from one of the provincial departments of health along the coast, and they provide the paramedic or the doctor. The rotation of paramedics or the movement of paramedics is not as great as the doctors. The doctors rotate much faster than the paramedics, so maintaining training in that environment is very difficult. But the paramedics certainly are trained in rescue and are trained to do these procedures and take the best of getting good all the way along the coast. There are a number of private ambulance services also, but their rescue training is not as good as the provincial service. The budget that I quoted to you there was purely a fuel cost. So I calculated an hourly cost of fuel to a superhuman helicopter. It excludes the cost of the aircraft, the amortization of the cost of the aircraft over time, or the crew cost, staff cost of all those. That is purely a quarantine cost per hour. So it gives you some idea of the cost. The training cost in terms of personnel will depend on the different organizations and the cost of the courses, which I can't put another number. The number of helicopter stations, those are stations, so I recommend 4 stations along the coast in those areas because of the shipping traffic. But each of those stations should have, at any time, an operational capacity to launch 2 long-range helicopters. So that might require a bigger fleet of helicopters within that station to be able to launch 2 that are operating. I mean, for example, in Cape Town at the moment, the 22 squadron has exercised. They can only launch 1 orange helicopter. There was a mountain rescue on the weekend on several mountains before we saw the newspaper. It took several hours to launch that helicopter while the patients are leaving on the island. So this, I mean, I'm equating the sea-based rescue issues at the moment, but there are also issues on them. In terms of time frames, I think what could be done within the South African Air Force is if they reconfigure their fleet and they redistribute the orange helicopters to coastal stations instead of inland stations, that would be one mechanism. They also obviously have inland pilots that could be redeployed to the coast and be trained. I mean, these are highly skilled professionals, and I can attest to their flying skills. I think training them up to be able to land on the sea wouldn't be a difficult task and wouldn't take so, I mean, I don't think the time frames are too long in being able to reconfigure the fleet, move the pilots around it, move some of the smaller aircraft and the aircraft in there, put the oranges on the coast, train up the engineers. I think maybe the land-based capacity is more of a serious problem. To train engineers, aircraft engineers, does take a while, so that may well be a limiting factor. The question in terms of Costa Concordia, for example, the Oceanus took 16 Oryx helicopters to solve that rescue problem of 300 passengers. Costa Concordia had 5,000 patients on board. So if, and you know that the Queen Mary and vessels like that are now docking in South African waters, if there was such an incident, you do not have the aircraft to launch a rescue operation of any substance from the air. Yes, you can launch by boat and every available vessel in terms of normal maritime practice would respond. But certainly, if it happened again on the Trans-Cross Coast, which is a very remote area, we don't have that as well. I think that's the message. The If you are talking about the landlord policy, that's one landlord policy in the first thing, it puts a not the one policy, but any one policy that can actually land on the policy. The other departments that are assisting, obviously the Department of Health provides the medical advice to assist, and then provide the medical crew, the paramedics and the doctors and the RCC. So we licensed as an NPO and as leading for social development, yes. The Department of Transport, obviously, the Department of Defense, and then there are various agencies. So, for example, with the Ebola virus, there are issues about immigration and home affairs and landing patients with Ebola and selecting ports and creating a major national disaster from a health point of view. So there are a lot of other agencies, border security and things that are involved from that point of view. When you have something like Ebola, and let me remind you that the Ebola issue still continues to this day, it doesn't go away. It's a serious issue. We have to first clear that patient before we can land them if they have any symptoms or anything that looks remotely like Ebola. Has there been any loss of life? Not today, but that's why I'm presenting the problem now, because we had two incidents where I needed lost volunteer crews. So these are not even employed people, these are volunteers. I think from a reputational point of view, if we lost a volunteer at sea, it would be an amazing task for the country, never mind for anyone else. So I think that's why I'm presenting it. I think that's what I'm saying, most of it.
Thank you very much. I think it's very, very clear. Honorable members, I'm just disappointed that the DDGs inside of this portfolio are not even here. That's an indication of undermining the critical mission that South Africa is supposed to interact with the international community at sea level. And we take let's just make this observation that we are highly disappointed. This is very, very important. We should be having somebody at a very high level, at the departmental level, who should be able to go into an executive meeting and say, these are the issues that you have identified, this is how I began to be able to solve some of the issues. We have identified that we need to talk to several other government departments, treasury should be involved, Department of Health should be involved, the Department of Defense should be involved, particularly the FAA, the South African Air Force, should be involved in this whole idea. But as you are saying this, operationally, how do we take it forward when the leadership of the department is not here? Probably we need to engage the minister in this whole situation. But we would really appreciate Dr. if you can be able to give us a total cost implication of this issue that we have spoken to. And there was an issue here of time frame. What do you expect the committee to do? How long do you think the committee will be able to look into this thing? Because it's critical. One life must be one life to many. And we're dealing with critical issues here. Actually, what was the committee that was being talked about the city mountain over the weekend? And it was just bringing to say, is it because of we will be dealing with this on Tuesday? A wake-up call? What exactly is in charge about this accident that happened over the weekend? But let's know the fact that the department is not here, so that we can be able to give instructions to the department, particularly the portfolio, the person in charge of this portfolio, so that we're able to make follow-ups. Writing letters is one thing, but talking to a person is something that really goes a long way, because we would want to see action, we would like to see something happening on matters of sea rescue, on matters of sea rescue and other institutions. We would appreciate Dr. Robert, if you can be able to, out of this meeting, send us the cost implications of what is expected, so that when we go meet with the other portfolio committees, we are able to say, having stepped down as the portfolio of transport, these are the issues that we believe we should be able to assist and actually besides giving us the cost implications, if we can be able to indicate what role will which department play, like you clearly indicated that for the defense, these are the things which are needed in terms of the infrastructure of the helicopters and all those things. If you are to indicate health, this is an muscles that you are having along the coast, this is what other things that you believe should be able to for the Department of Health to reach into. And the question of also from your side, training of other major portfolios within your ambit that you are able to really take into consideration so that when we deal with these things, we take that into consideration as a holistic picture that we'll be able to take us forward. Thank you very much on that note. We really appreciate your coming here, and it's definitely something that we will put a hawk's eye on. It's something that we really can't ignore any further. Because the president says Operation Pakisa FC, this is what is going to be happening. Out of what you're saying, we already see industries emerging out of section the maintenance of the helicopters and other related issues. We already see the human development coming into the picture in this whole thing. Holistically, so with not necessarily at the portfolio level, but every other portfolio. These are the things which the National Development Plan is talking. So thank you very much for the presentation. Thank you very much. We going back to Uber. Where is Uber? I'll send you to Sanjan and then you'll check it. Thank you. Honorable Mlaudi, I wanted to do a similar thing to say, I want to welcome Honorable Keita. We know that she has been challenged physically, and we really enjoy that at least she can have a smile on the face.
Yeah.
We wish you a very speedy recovery as you coming into this committee. Honorable members must just know that. I just don't want to talk to the issue of the week because we, me and him, we don't have an issue.
Yeah, I'm going
to take it. He actually assisted me to get them, so we found him on
them.
Thank you very much. My honor. I don't know.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sheikh, and that's a very warm welcome to you.
Thank you for having us. Good morning to the members of the committee for your opinion. My name is Jamal Mishu. I am responsible for public policy for the first part. For this to help the town and inform our biggest cities in the region. So, to ask the say, any questions that I think are better teachers for the people who are actually the work. We've brought two of the partner drivers with us today. And behind me, we've got Five House, we've got Derek. And behind you, ma'am, there is a channel you can use. They are the two of the partner drivers. Now, whilst we say we are a technology company, these are the people that you encounter every day on a daily basis who are actually the partner drivers. The space that companies decide to have, and that's what we should bring in today. Alon will begin shortly by introducing us. He will go through the presentation quite in summary version to what he's doing, but at the end of the interest of time. We want to allow as much time for questions as possible, and then we'll take it from there. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having us here. It is our honor. Just to kick it off, what you'll see is that Uber was launched in South Africa in August 2013, Johannesburg being the first African city. It was quickly followed by launches in Cape Town and Durban, and we lost operations as well. So we're in the four main hubs of South Africa. What you'll see is we're now in actually over 60 countries around the world and over 300 cities. So Johannesburg was launched in August 2013, it was the 34th city. So just gives you a sense for the growth that's been experienced within Uber. An interesting point to raise here is that South Africa is the first country outside the US. Uber is a US company that has three cities operational at the same time as my colleague Joe's point. It just shows you how excited we are about the opportunity here in South Africa. And I'll get into that in more detail. So as Joe mentioned, Uber is not a transportation provider. Uber is a technology platform. It's a smartphone application. You can download it from either the Apple Store, the Google Store, or by the smartphone. When you open it up, it's GPS-based technology. So what you'll see on the screen on the left is a picture of what the map looks like. So it picks up your location. You'll be able to see cars available to pick you up on the map. So from a transparency perspective, you know exactly how long it will take for the closest car to get to you. When you book the trip, from a safety perspective, you get to see your driver's name, the car that he or she is driving, their number plate, and the car information. So it's not about getting to a random car on a random corner, it's completely trackable. You can actually also watch that car drive towards you in real time. So there's no waiting outside on a random street corner for a car to arrive. Everything's shared using the technology. And one of the important factors is the rating system at the end of the trip. So at the end of the trip, you can visit your founder rating, and they'd like to know whether you had a good or bad experience. And that rating system goes both ways. In the same way that riders rate their drivers, drivers actually rate their riders in the trip. So it's important that there's mutual respect on the platform. If we flip over the slide, I think I've touched on those features. Just to give you a sense for the growth in South Africa, we've been extremely humbled by how quickly South Africans have adopted the technology. And during 2014, over 1 million trips were booked on the platform across the city. And already in 2015, in the first 6 months of the year, we've seen over 2 million trips booked on the platform. So what this shows you is that Uber is becoming part of the public transport infrastructure within South Africa. And part of the reason why is because Uber provides safe, reliable transport within minutes. So we're at a stage now across all the cities where we operate that within less than 5 minutes you open up the application and you can get a reliable ride. And what this starts to do, it starts to change the mindset of people within the city. They now know that no matter where they are in the city, they have an affordable, reliable way to get around. And the growth that we've seen in the country has really humbled us, as I've said, and as Joe mentioned, we've seen great growth both amongst riders and our partner drivers. What we've seen up until the beginning of January is over 2,000 partner drivers, like our partner drivers in the room today, are using the platform on a daily basis. And Uber creates a powerful entrepreneurship opportunity for these individuals. Rather than let me speak to those opportunities and speak to the way that technology is really changing lives, I'll let partner drivers speak to that a little bit later. Just a point to raise that, that whilst we've already created over 2,000 economic opportunities to date, we are on track and very confident that we'll be creating additional 15,000 work opportunities over the next 2 years. So in the context of South Africa, we really see this as an amazing opportunity for empowerment, for job creation, so something that we're extremely proud of and excited to achieve. Just to show you very briefly, what this map shows you, the little blue box on the map, is where someone unique opened up to the application for the first time. So what it shows you in that map share of all three cities is that people want to use Uber all around our community. So it's not limited to certain areas. Literally all over our city, people are opening up the application and are wanting to use Uber as a way to get around. And now all of a sudden, areas that were previously underserved by taxi, where it took you maybe up to an hour or sometimes even more to get a car, you can get a reliable ride within minutes.
This is we are putting in numerous support measures to make
show that we manage also boundaries and open boundaries, and also say as much as we will fire and support sponsors and also the master to make sure that we support independent operators in the drivers to graduate into the independent operation. We have amazing those stories, there's a question from Barbara and Shalom, who were sending the video of it, trying to find the ticket cost. Just a quick benefit of being a sponsor driver, what we try to find finance, making a decision in terms of the taxes, we're trying to create a fear. What we found is when something wants to come to the state of Florida, because of socioeconomic conditions, they didn't necessarily have the access that we need to capital So we create a vehicle financing platform that they can access. We create rent-to-own schemes of vehicles that they can access. And we also negotiate insurance for them, running down the cost of owning the business so they can be a successful small business in their own right. Ultimately, what we're trying to do is we are trying to get as many people using public transportation services. We are participating in the eco-mobility management studios over the community in the time line. And the end of it is to take people outside the public transport and let them know that this vehicle on the road is in congestion, which is something that our city is considering to tackle. One of the things that the city is doing is raise how do we reduce the occupancy of vehicles, and we're working with them, looking at various mechanisms, how do we get reduce the occupancy of vehicles and reduce people driving for the really, what you have for what you say of a challenge of the law. Within the NLTA Act of Crime Charity, we have grappled as to what is the first category that a transport native operator should do. And that's what the categorized operators as a technology sector. Need of our goods or recruitment of technology-enabled companies. Where should they be? Should they be under charter services? Should they be under media services? Where in that? We are aligned with the international public transport in that we can legally, that we are entering into services so far, as a discrimination of the city and the case. But what we are finding is that none of the existing categories really accommodate the partner. From the traditional practices that you might be seeing, is that a mere taxi might rank. Uber partner, a technology network operator need not rank. There might be route restrictions. Those do not facilitate a point-to-point transport network operator. So there is a need for a discussion in the future about how do you frame the business framework that can accommodate the innovation that technology is bringing about. I think we'll pause for this now and we'll allow the questions and that's what we're also doing.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. We welcome this presentation by AHA. But there, I've got two or three questions to ask for clarity. One thing to check is to looking at the waiting time, there are differences there. What made some other times to have lower lineage of operating than others. And also, I'd love to check out there is something that speaks to the job creation of more of about 15,000 more jobs. But I'm not sure if it's clearly stated here as to from when we started, how many of the jobs that we have been able to create. And looking at what we have created now since you started, do you think you'll be able to get to the 15,000 more? And how do you intend achieving that target?
I just want to say a few things. This should be not more known. Presentations are of the same, they're not
transport provider, and a technology provider. Are you implying that you somehow have a net responsibility for the vehicles and the drivers? The reason I ask this is because there's been a tug of war in the West Coast, for example, where some Ubers are not registered. There's a meter taxi, and the meter taxi is an international registration. And the provincial governments, I'm sure other governments will be doing the same, are just adhering to that national legislation. Why? I mean, how is it that some of the drivers are not registered? And what has been done to repeat this problem? And then my third question is, there was when kind of Uber came out, it was a big thing, you know, if I can listen to media circles, there was a great resistance by the traditional media taxi operators. With Uber coming to the market and invading the space and so on. We just talk about that and move on with it. Thank you.
I should say three questions. Firstly, deriving from personal experience in using Uber, whether the technology as we experience it currently in terms of the service delivery and the way that we provide the service, whether that is the complete package and stuff of software, since I would find it a lot better to call a location that's registered with the driver. So that you also have a sense of how far the driver is away, although you might have that on your screen, but it appears for some strange reason and another driver might be approaching. Then it would be a lot easier for the driver then to have an indication on the user or phone of where the caller actually would be. Second question, I like the 5-star rating system, because I think it's a very positive way to incentivize driver habits and behavior. Something I think one should consider for the bigger transport industry. And then the more critical question is, can you give us a rundown of the current status in terms of licenses and outstanding licenses and what you are doing about that? Because certainly it might be seen as very convenient to say, you know, we're only responsible for the software, we're not responsible for the registration, licenses, and so on. I want you to react to that very critical question. What is your position with regards to that? And what is the current balance in terms of how many have been listed and how many not have been?
Welcome the presentation. I'm mostly covered by my colleagues. However, I have two questions in the main. I think they are submitting a substantial amendment of legislation. Section 71 and section 89 talk about rationalization and publication of the initiative. I would also like to know from transport if they are here, what is their position in the sector. We have to go through this section because they might have an impact on other operators. We don't just agree to something on the face of the secrets here. What might be good for New York might not be good for South African places. Well, like different cultures, they might not have the type of tensions between those bandits or Soweto in New York. They have the yellow tensions and other stuff. The other issues, Jefferson, on the document which is entitled Confidential, that's what I'm reading from, and Google's. They are also saying that the Department of Transport must relook on the prohibition of road registration. You want to operate all over without registration? Well, we have problems. there are bus operators, there are things. You are not the only transport operator. But if this is what is proposed, represent on bullet point 2, page 3, 5, 9, maybe when they are gone, we'll have to go through what are suggested here. Because what far is seen in this question, I don't know whether other operators will agree with this, that you can go anywhere. I can see your motivation in that if route restrictions are imposed, the aging drivers, riders, and broader urban population. But what about the other operators? So, I understand you are presenting your case. You can't speak for others.
Yeah.
It is us elected representatives who have to speak for them with the Department of Transport, because the government agency. So, present your case, but I think some of the issues that you are raising here are far-reaching implications. But we welcome the innovation that is there in the industry. Thank you.
Indeed. Also, I was just looking at the issue of the oil restrictions on the country. I mean, if you can't regulate the oil prices, you're going to kill our people. I can't have anything. Because once you don't monitor the level of prices, we find our people not being able to operate. But I try to understand something. There were clashes between Uber and other electricity operators. How do you manage to solve the problem? That's what I get to understand. But in terms of coming with these proposals, who do you call first? Because the first proposal, they've got a lot of impact. If it can be changed, you know, as they are proposing, that means our producers are going to be affected, and other electricity operators are going to be affected. Have you contracted with all the different stakeholders? And what is that going to do? We appreciate the creativeness in ensuring that we provide job opportunities and technology design. But I'm trying to also check what are the limitations of this technology design? Because I know that there are those particular challenges, but also the how far do you really to probably expand or educate other people about this particular issue? Yes.
No, thank you very much, Honorable Chair, and thanks for the presentation. Now, Chair, you will forgive me because probably one of the slowest learning students in class, in your class. So the presentation is well and good. There seems to be a strong argument that this coordination, technology coordination, is part of public transport, integrated public transport, for instance. And I have a question, why is that argument? Because if I listen to the presentation, actually it's having at the top end of the market. It's an individual call transport. So if you look at the volume of the public transport needs, therefore I fail to grasp this issue that it can be issue. Now, and I know that around the cities, various cities will have this let's see, you can call it, you can use the telephone, you can use the number they have, and call to your call. But that remains add to the whatever integrated public transportation. So individual based transport or call that remains. So you educate me about that issue, because I'm struggling to understand it. Being the land, a slow person who drives very slow. Now the app that you have invention of it. I just want to understand the invention of the app. I mean, it's a good thing to have, but there is probably the royalty and ownership of the app, and if the basket of the resource get into that, obviously the royalty and the payment comes out of the top. So actually the ownership of the app, investment of the app, is where the money goes. In that level. Now, who owns the app? Now this app, and I think the other members have asked the question, that there has been some tension that seems to be made. Because it's simply a competition. The top end of the competition in terms of a call to service. Those that don't have that system, those meters that are waiting on the street, until you come, you walk to them. So there's always been that tension. Of course, that's a change of business, I think, I suppose. Nothing we can do about it here. But the point I'm trying to get to, if we're talking about legislation, and the legislation, the provision for legislation makes way for this specific act going forward, it is not fragmented. Now, it says there's a restriction of the rules. One of the sources of conflict is adopted transport, particularly the small and medium transport. So all those adopted nodes between linked and bridges in the route-based transport. That is why the legislation recently was changed into a network system. And to confine people in various places where they are, and to minimize conflict. So then now I ask the question, if we're talking about the restriction, lowering down, relaxing, elastic boundaries, network cutting, and are we adding to the conflict or minimizing the conflict? And this is a significant problem. Remember the app, we did say that it was launched on 2013 conference. But we have a challenge of yesterday that we're still fighting at the moment, including the current conflict of integrated public transport to make space for minibus taxis as a feeder system to other transport systems. So now the financing side, there's a slide that talks to the finance and so on. Now, who's the driver? Who's the driver? There's something about the driver. I was trying to struggle with this thing. The driver and the partner driver. Interchangeably. Is it an individual who owns a vehicle, who then register to be part of the pool that is located within the Uber system, and therefore is benefiting based on the location by the registration of that, and what is the payment, what is the cost to the registration part into the system in order to call for it. are all these people that are operating under Uber. The question is, do they have operating license? Or the operating license is not necessarily applicable? So I was following the newspaper article in one of the housing homes. Sometimes there were some people who were driving the Audi. So I took time to try and read the details. And the problem of the distribution is that other person, we are subjected to having a permit. Now these other motor vehicles are controlled from somewhere through the court system, and then you just see, and you don't quite know whether it is a license or not. Perhaps it's one of the areas why you're asking us to engage at some point with the relooking at the legislation. The last one for me, I did make the point right at the beginning about the slowness here. The process, the gateway for the legislative amendment and engagement and negotiation for that before even gets to us is the authority department platform. Now, what are the engagements? What are the engagements? Who is the engagement with them and yourself around this? What is their view around some of the issues that are raised? Is there any disagreement so that we understand them? Within that process of the amendment, it's still a distance away. From time to understand, from where I'm sitting, where is this lobby? Which is the lobbying perspective here? Is it to resolve the unresolved and unstable between for the Department of Transport as authority and this is anything that, and I see they may take a dim view around the restriction that we're going to be imposing them about in terms of almost like deregulation of the network system or permit is not. So I don't know whether they will take probably a dim view. Are they taking a dim view? Are they having some issues that you call me unsafe that you would not want to disclose here at the moment? So you stand surety for those drivers when they have to get a car or they want to bring in for someone who wants to buy a car and they have to do. So you stand in for it. And then is a cost factor in for the individual during that period. Was it built into the part of the realm of the talk? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Even the current dilemma, I'm sure this is not going to be so that we can help the
honorable
member.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I don't think I'm back so far into the report, because I'm up too long. Well, firstly, thank you for the presentation. The presentation looks a lot like my previous pages. Now, my concern really is we've been talking about creating work opportunities as independent operators. But what is of concern to me is there any vetting of new drivers that come on board? Is there any restriction? Who can join this partnership? Is there any specification in terms of the types of vehicles that are used? I think that would be important. Then also, your credit card is debited directly. The question is, what percentage goes to the driver, what percentage actually stays with Uber? You know, for example, say the income, is there any restrictions to the number of trips, the number of kilometers that can be done in a day? Is there a restriction to the time on the road? I've used other taxi services, especially in the housing area before, where the driver says to me that's emergency 3 o'clock that morning and it is now already 11 o'clock at night. So So it becomes a road safety problem. So I just want to try and find out about those types of restrictions. If they also look at the cost of, I want to give an example. For example, my daughter, I've had to use a shuttle to get her from school here and take someone before the shuttle service because I won't let my child get into it in the taxi. For safety reasons, the shuttle service starts in 220 rand where the cost of Uber was 75 or 70 rand. So you've got to try and have a look and see, you know, what is the cost, the average per kilometer compared to if we look at a meter taxi. I think I'm going to set for the legislation. Yeah, and then I just think it's really important to this road safety, the amount of time. Unfortunately, I didn't have access to the confidential documents, but it wasn't emailed, so I think I'll just get a copy of it and go through that paper. Thank you.
Also, in particular, in the secondary
and then have an understanding of where we would like to take transport, integrated transport issues to. Because remember, we still have other issues of BRT and the holistic integrated transport issues which we may want to deal with. This is what I'm telling to yourself, that we may want to think along those lines, partner with the legislatures on this matter, so that we don't just do it teaching, but let's engage so that our colleagues at the legislature will also be able to have an understanding. I don't want to go, I think we have eloquently covered issues of legislation, because those three were some of the issues that I wanted to really talk to. So let me give it back to yourself so that we can be able to respond. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. And I guess the layout of the city. So it's a lot easier in a city like Cape Town, where distances between different locations are a lot smaller versus Joburg, where distances are larger. So in essence, you need to have more vehicles on the road in a city like Johannesburg to achieve the lower waiting times versus a city like Cape Town. In terms of the jobs created since launch, there have been over 2,000 jobs created through the technology. And the number that we want to achieve, as you mentioned, is 15,000. We are on track to achieve that in terms of our forecast, and some of the initiatives that we have in play are partnership with private enterprise, where we're changing the mindset around allowing an individual who previously wouldn't qualify for credit. On the back of a partnership with Uber, we have a history in terms of earnings of that individual, and you now can show the lending institution that this individual now has a real opportunity to earn income if you extend him or her a loan to access a vehicle. It's not a vehicle for consumer purposes, it's really a small business loan. So those are the types of initiatives that we work on to ensure that we meet the target of 15,000. Hopefully if there is some time at the end, we can allow our partner drivers to speak just for 2 minutes. In terms of the question around law enforcement, a meeting that happened not so long ago with Alderman Smith in Cape Town was potentially how can you use the Uber partner drivers on the road as some form of community watch. These individuals are driving through neighborhoods, they're on the road, they're aware of what's going on around them. Can you give them some form of way of contacting law enforcement and tipping them off of suspicious behavior? And that's definitely something that we would be open to. If you think about the fact that no matter where we are in the city, there's an Uber within 5 minutes, it's actually a very interesting partnership with the public sector. Since we have operating licenses, I think Joe will handle the questions around operating licenses, opportunities around expansion. Most definitely expansion is something that we are committed to. Uber as a company globally say that as long as there's a population bigger than 200,000 people, we want to be in that city. So if we think about that in the context of South Africa, there is a lot of expansion opportunity within the coming months. So we are excited about that and are committed about that. The financial implication of being a partner driver, so just to understand that, there are no joining fees to partner with Uber. So the way it works, and I'm just going to talk through the process of application because I think there are a number of questions around that. In order to partner with Uber as a driver, drivers have to come through with a professional driver's permit. In addition to obtaining the professional driver's permit, drivers have to go through an additional criminal background check through the police agency system. So additional checks ensure that we partner with the safest drivers on the road. Assuming everything checks out, drivers do have to go through an interview process where their city knowledge is assessed, as well as their basic customer service. Assuming all of that checks out, there are vehicle documentation requirements.
the vehicle documentation requirements are first and foremost commercial vehicle insurance, passenger liability, third party liability, and public liability insurance. In addition to that, all vehicles have to have road ready certificates and operator's cards. In fact, we've instituted a partnership with a third party provider that performs a check on the vehicle, both mechanical and optical, to check that the vehicle is in good working order before the vehicle is allowed onto the platform. As to what the vehicle specifications are, we do set the requirements of the vehicles that can gain access to the platform. It differs per city. As an example, in Johannesburg, the vehicles have to be 2012 or newer, and the vehicle specifications depend on the vehicle category. So we like to give consumers options. We have the Uber Black option, which is a premium product, the likes of a Mercedes-Benz, an Audi, or a BMW. The price point on that product is 11 Rand per kilometer in Cape Town and 1 Rand 10 per minute. And in Johannesburg, that's 13 Rand per kilometer and 1 Rand 30 per minute. The great thing about the application is that you can obtain a fare quote before requesting your trip. So there's no need to haggle with the driver, and there's no shock at the end of the trip. You can obtain that fare quote if you disagree with the quote that was provided. Although the amount is higher than the quote that was provided, you can query that at the end of your trip. In terms of the Uber X product, it's the likes of a Toyota Corolla or a VW Polo. All those vehicles, as I mentioned before, are inspected. And then the final requirement is the operating license. As you're aware, there has been some controversy around that around the country. I'll leave that to Joe to handle at the end. The cost to an Uber partner driver, as I mentioned, no joining fees, no annual fees. The cost to an Uber partner driver are when a trip is booked through the platform. So Uber takes a 20% service fee in exchange for our technology, and the balance being the 80% goes to the partner driver. So if a driver is on the platform and doesn't do any rides, then there's no cost to him or her. There is an option if a partner driver does not have a phone, where they can get a phone with the Uber application loaded onto it. If they do choose to opt for that, there is a cost involved to cover the cost of that device. Otherwise, a partner driver can come in with his or her own phone, and there's no additional cost involved. In terms of fare hikes, and I think it was a point that was alluded to earlier, is that the fares that we offer through the UberX product are actually the most competitive in the market. On average across the country, we're 35% cheaper than metered taxi. And an important point to highlight there is that lower fares do not mean lower earnings for partner drivers. If we think about what a driver can be doing if him or her are online on the Uber application during the day, they can be doing one of three things. First of all, they can be waiting for a pickup, they can be driving to collect the passenger, or they can be carrying their passenger to the ultimate destination. What Uber is about is reducing the first two. So what we've seen through lower fares is much higher demand. So drivers spend less time waiting for pickup, less time driving towards their clients to pick him or her up, so less dead kilometers in the system, and more time earning carrying passengers to their ultimate destination. So what we've seen is that lower fares have actually translated to higher earnings. And hopefully our partner drivers can talk to that specifically rather than letting me quote amounts. So some challenges that we've seen in all countries around the world. I think all countries around the world have seen similar challenges. I think one of those main challenges relates to the regulatory environment, where we have a case where regulation is lagging innovation, and current regulation does not necessarily cater for the way that Uber partners operate. And that's one of the main reasons as to why we're here today. And part of the reason why we've been engaging with policymakers across cities, provinces, and at a national level for well over a year now. In terms of the issue around responsibility between drivers, Uber, who really holds the responsibility, I think a lot of this goes down to the point I mentioned earlier around the screening process. So the drivers that have access to the platform have a professional driver's permit. In addition to that, those vehicles are insured. So if an individual is involved in an accident in a vehicle that was booked using the Uber platform, they will have a claim against that individual's insurance, and they will have a claim against the road accident fund. We have seen some resistance from existing taxi operators in Taipei. To the point there, it's all about consultation, it's about engagement, it's about trying to open up doors for these individuals who may not have vehicles that qualify or quite meet the criteria that we set out, so they can now get access to finance and now partner with Uber going forward. How does the technology work? I think the point that you raised around the issues that you were having with the Uber application, I think that is maybe an older version of the application. The way it should work is that you open up the application. Once you book your trip, you do see exactly how long it will take for that closest driver to arrive. That driver won't change, and you'll see that time decrease as the car gets closer, and you'll actually get a notification when the car's outside. A thing which we have instituted in South Africa is anonymized calling to ensure that the driver doesn't get the rider's details and the rider doesn't get the driver's details. So it's very important from a safety perspective that everyone can remain in contact, but that those details remain private. The rating system, I think, is a great way to start thinking about the service industry in terms of how drivers treat their riders, and importantly, how riders treat their drivers. I think previously, the transport industry was an industry where people were taken for granted and not treat drivers with respect, whereas on the Uber platform, it's very important that the respect goes both ways, and riders treat drivers with respect. That business people who are building a business for themselves and for their families. Just a side point, we've often get notes from people who use Uber around the world as to how the Uber partner drivers in South Africa are amongst the most professional in the world, and they've received the highest levels of service in South Africa, and we're over 300 cities, so that's quite a claim to make. There's just some questions around the relationship with the Uber. I think there was a question around our willingness to educate. We definitely willing to educate, we're willing to see how we can use technology to make our cities better. I think an interesting point that you think of, if you think about Uber, the number of trips being completed on a daily basis, there's access to a lot of data. And that data on an aggregated basis gives you a feel for how cities move, how people get around their cities, what areas are popular, what times of day are popular. And we can use that technology together with government to help our cities run better. And when you start thinking about integrated transport plans, that information becomes very powerful to start implementing this and including this as part of integrated transport plans. The invention of the application, it was the idea behind Uber was come up with by our co-founders in 2009 in Paris. They were walking through the streets of Paris in the snow, and they thought there has to be a better way to get around the city. And both of them are engineers by way of background. They went back to their home in San Francisco, developed Uber's application, and it's growing quite quickly from there. In terms of the flows, which is a point that came up before, as I mentioned, 80% of the partner drivers, 20% of Uber, the technology provider. I don't think a point, and I think the misconception is that we're cutting out competition. Uber is an open technology platform. It's open to existing transport providers. In fact, in Cape Town, there are a huge number of existing meter taxi operators who use Uber to supplement their business. So they continue to operate in the way that they did before Uber entered the market, but they use Uber when they are not busy to supplement their income and earn more. So the technology is definitely open, and any barriers which currently exist we're looking to remove. Okay, so just to, I guess, remove our jargon around who's a driver, who's a partner. What we refer to partner drivers as the individuals who are using the application. In some cases, you have a partner who owns the vehicle, and then he employs the driver. As Joe mentioned, something which we're very committed to is ensuring that drivers have direct access to finance so they can own their own vehicles and really maximize their own profits, versus having to go through a middleman who owns the vehicle. As I mentioned, the cost of registration is zero. Obviously, the cost to register the vehicle, but to register with Uber is zero. So, at the moment, we don't stand surety for partner drivers if they're looking to get finance, but as I mentioned before, given the data that we have access to, given the fact that we've now been operating in South Africa for over 2 years, you can start to create a credit history. So if you look at a partner driver who's been on the platform, not owning his or her own vehicle, but driving for someone else, if you look at their earnings on a weekly basis, maybe they've been making 8,000 Rand, 10,000 Rand per week over the last 6 months. But because they don't own the vehicle, that money is then paid to someone else, and that individual is only being paid a salary on a weekly basis. So if a bank looks at that individual, they'll see that salary coming in on a weekly basis, so maybe 2,000 Rand a week, and they wouldn't then necessarily qualify for vehicle finance. But what the bank should really be doing is looking at that 8,000 Rand that that individual is generating through this platform on a weekly basis. And as soon as banks start taking that approach, and they are already doing so, with some pilots in play across all cities, with the view of us broadening this offering to more partner drivers, more individuals will be able to gain access to finance. So just two final points from me, and I'm going to hand over to Joe, is that we are most definitely committed to ensuring that more female partner drivers gain access to the platform. We have a commitment globally as a company that by 2020, there'll be 1 million female partner drivers on the platform. That's something which we're very committed to, and Fadi shared today, and hopefully she can speak to her own experience. Another point which I just want to raise is youth. It's a great youth channel for youth to enter the job market. It's something which individuals can potentially do while they're studying towards a further qualification, helping them earn income on this side around the schedule. One of the main reasons why partner drivers enjoy partnering with Uber is because they have the flexibility of their own time. They set their own hours and when they want to work and where they want to work, so it fits around their own schedule. The final point in closing for me is around disability. Functionality, which we've recently launched in Kenya, which we hope to bring to South Africa quite soon, is functionality giving deaf or hard of hearing drivers access to the Uber platform. If you look at the way that the Uber platform currently works, it actually beeps when a request comes through for the driver. So rather than having it beep, we've changed the functionality for deaf or hard of hearing partners to let it flash. It also notifies the person requesting a trip that individual is deaf or hard of hearing, and prompts them to enter their destination into the application. So when the driver then arrives, the destination enters, there's no awkward communication between the driver and the rider, and that individual is now empowered to enter an industry which is quite difficult to enter before then enhancing that technology. So in that, I thank you very much for the opportunity, and I'd like to touch on the regulatory questions.
Just very briefly, just to speak about
the
compliance with the LGA, the consultation with the different parties, and the fusion with the regulators that we need. One, it is completely possible for a Google operator to be compliant with the LGA today. The discussion is involved in that planning authorities around the country are now designated Google partner drivers, and the question is also the leader countries to capture the carrier. What they're doing is specifying in-game services operating after the condition. Now, that is every single Uber partner on the road today is in the process of getting an operating license. Not a single one of them is not. There are challenges around how far the operating licenses are approaching, but we are engaging with every single tiny authority to be able to get an operation to make sure that do bring those operations to full compliance as soon as possible, either efficient, while we see ourselves turning into the broader public partnership structure, so that if we're going to operate in the space, like you say, we're going to have to do so in a way that respects players that are in the market already, and that complements the environment that they take away. So that's why we absolutely want to get to the question of how we can plug into it, how parts of the network operators can plug into integrating integrated cost profit plan. What we are seeing is that while the technology may have started servicing people, say, detention, it's very rapidly moving into areas where it's CBD, where it's Soweto, it's broadening the reach, and that's because seamlessness and the safety of the service and affordability of it is making is very embarrassing. In terms of consultation with industry players, we are in constant dialogue, particularly in Saudi with the College of Professional Technical Council. The NEC, the political NEC of Transport, has been very gracious in the facilitation of that discussion with the College of Professional Technical Council. And what that discussion focuses on is how can existing effective operators take advantage of the technology that we offer to enhance their business. So what is being envisioned right now is a pilot phase where we take the media sector, the same media sector content that we are seeing when they use the first one, which is the expansion station, how do we take them and bring them onto the mobility platform? And like I said, those discussions are being facilitated by the existing platform. And same is happening in the business where we are talking to this is not to say that it's smooth sailing. It is, we are trying to introduce a change, and from time to time, there's difficulty. Now, as a last point, in terms of the future regulation, the current difficulty that large compliance with NLTA today is possible, it's absolutely possible. There is a difficulty in differentiating the type of service that a transportation operator offers and what that which is put forward in the North State. And the rationale that we put into our thinking is how do you best maximize the efficiency of an operator and maximize the efficiency in the that's what forms it. So when you see something like, let's say, no route restriction, it is for a specific category of operations, not necessarily applicable to the entire and it's mentioned is the future of the media taxi going to work with these restrictions. It will move into a point-to-point environment, a user can request a ride in Hammarskjöld, go to Victoria, and then the same operator has to go to the Trillium and go to the airport. Do restrictions help the efficiency of that particular operator or not? So it's not done without thinking why there's a rationale for restrictions at all. But it is important to differentiate the type of service. Just a huge area of agreement between us and existing litex operators. They are as provided for in the Act that you can come to a fee, you can agree on a fee by any other type of means. Media tax operators no longer see the need for a sealed meter as is currently catered for in the Act. And we agree with them. They also don't see this foresee a future where they rent. And this is another area of agreement between us and the media tax council. So the consultation about what a future conversation could look like all going on, and we are looking forward to participating in that. We also make every means to communicate with the Department of Transport, and the ideas that we are saying here are ideas that we are communicating to the Department of Transport as well. So consultation is happening, and we're looking forward to making input into the regulation.
Thank you very much. Honourable Omar Tata, the second chance is going to be very short and compact. Mr. Hawk, why don't you let me start off with you and show your hand. Honourable Omar Tata will speak to the last speaker, Honourable Keita, and then we'll close it on that note.
Thanks, Chairperson. Good morning to the honorable members of the SS Department who note the presentation by Eva. But one thing that we want to make very clear is that our legislation is the way. It recognizes transport of cost as applications and improvements in terms of the horizon. And I should indicate that Chairperson, Uber, as it were, started in 2009. And in 2009, the parliament was in effect in 2009, the company was launched in 2013. And I think our take is that while all of us are quite happy about the innovations that are coming in the form, but regarding our policy making processes, especially introducing of new content, we take note that any policy that is coming in needs to take care of the economy, the social and environmental implications as it well. And of course, our role as a department is to continuously engage any person that comes to the fore and present their case. And I should indicate that the department is currently in the process of doing the National Land Transport Act. It's not a done deal as well. I think that's one thing that we actually want to clarify on the issue that has been raised, that is important to actually comply to the National Land Transport Act. And our view is that currently as a department, our attempt can be to see how best we can through regulations control the technology and the other operators. But one thing that we're not going to control the facilitation of that, which is Uber in this case. So we continue to engage with Uber and also other players. And also notice that in the space there has been other players that have come in, such as Snapchat, JavaCap, in the main test, indicated to us moving forward that there will be a proliferation of such. And the site needs a regulatory environment that will be properly certified, that is regulated and controlled in order to prevent abuses as well. Those are the sentiments that we wanted to actually start with the community. Thank you.
No, Chair, let me just say, in terms of the interest of time, especially your view, that maybe we should indicate that we know from the implementation that as a committee, we would, of course, going forward, engage with what we have here in our own community engagement. Some concerns that we have, we will continue to engage with those. And at the end of the process, the legislative process will come to us, and then we will express a view on that. So I wanted to just say that Uber should not understand from today that everybody is happy and we all have a thumbs up and the system goes, and we have a step. There is no step. That you have here, but you have presented in a case that would have to be mined and engaged with. I don't want to talk about the 50% royalty and good credit speaking and all that, and we will engage with that one in our own space.
In essence, I'm saying this is work in progress. Like I have made a proposal earlier on, which is probably the community we have to talk to. Honorable Keita, you have. Thank you very much, honorable members. I think this is work in progress, which actually will help to. We will have to make sure that we do more research, more findings, engage with the other stakeholders in the same business. As the department has indicated, look into the legislation, the regulations, what exactly are the issues. But what becomes critical here to all of us, one of you has already indicated, we're looking for particular market, particular clientele, and at the center is that South Africans should be able to move from point A to B. Moving transport is one of the critical things which actually is the Republic of South Africa. Economically, environmentally, socially, we should be able to really look deeper into it so that it can be able to make sure that critical aspects of people's lives are impacted on positively. Let me thank the presentation on behalf of the committee and say this is the beginning work in progress. If there's other things that you believe you still need to give information to the committee on, we are through how you got through to us. We are ready and we'll be looking forward. Thank you very much. The next item is ex-metro rail security workers, that's item number 3, to reduce people from Uber. The driver did not have an opportunity to talk. One day you will talk. Enjoy your day.
Thank you.
To present before you this presentation. Great presentation.
emanates from a number of people, about 500 in number initially, who have been employed by Russia at the state or referred to as Metro Rail South Africa, based in Devon. I tried to forward a memorandum which I believe must have been circulated to some of you for the sake of brevity. Our office, as you know, has been assisting these people on pro bono basis. We were approached as the Artelis firm known as Miami Lingering Company, which was established by the legend Griffith Louis Mutanga, as well as the lead Munyama Zedo Victoria Mutanga. I had the honor of working with those persons, and Fabrizio was admitted as a partner. And I'm the sole surviving proprietor of the particular institution. But as I said, I'm not here in that capacity as an attorney, but merely as a representative duly requested by the various people I've referred to on almost pro bono basis. This delegation of ex-employees has been requested to put forward the plight of these people I've referred to. From the memorandum submitted, I don't know whether all of us have said, because a few people just abbreviate the whole scenario. If I may summarize it, these people have been working indirectly for Metro Rail South Africa Prasa. Others, the minimum years spent or served, 3 years, and maximum 14 years. I may point out that there was a system that was applied, namely that of labor brokers. What happened here? Metro Rail got service providers, particularly in KZN. I remember some of them sitting in Kijana, KZN, and many others. The modus operandi was as follows. Those people would be granted contracts to serve Metro Rail, which is a parastata, for a certain period of time, in most cases 2 years. After 2 years, the contracts terminated, and other subcontractors would come to play. But what was particular about this instance was that, yes, the subcontractors would be changed their packages. The term would terminate, and another subcontractor would come in, but what was striking was that the number of people I referred to would remain as if nothing had happened. They rendered services directly to Metro Rail. Supervision and all was conducted and done by Metro Rail, the power station. So as time went on, these unfortunate individuals raised their pride with Metro Rail because, as I said, the benefits of the thing was done by the subcontractor service providers. It had an effect that negotiations were then on that the subcontracting system, which is despised by many of us, would be phased out, and accordingly, those who have served, as you see from the notes I provided, ladies and gentlemen, would be considered for obvious reasons, because there were exceptional circumstances. For instance, on my left, the gentleman that served Metro Rail through the specialist I've referred to for a period of 14 years. So, in actual fact, all these people who were initially 500 were perpetual, casual laborers. So, having raised this, there were negotiations which were mainly with Metro Rail high-ranking officers that look, we are going to attend to this issue. This went on and on and on until at some stage they said, look, we have been giving this service for some time. We would like to get some time frames as to how this was to be implicated. And then as a result, there was what would normally happen, Obama mandate, withholding our services, which is a democratic way of raising anybody's concern about the situation that may be troubling him or her at a particular moment. When that occurred, of course, the subcontractors who were talent service providers of the Parasita Metro Rail were standing by. In other words, when this meeting was held, little or nothing they could do because they were, as I put, figureheads. They were not in actual participation or control. They were there for the convenience of certain individuals within the process. So what happened, this was regarded as an industrial action, which was directly addressed by Metro Rail officials or officers. And again, the various employees I'm referring to resumed duties in anticipation that indeed what, as you see, for instance, the letter I've referred to, which was dated the 3rd of, I think it was the possession of, 3rd of April 2008. This is just to show you how old the matter is. As a result of that meeting, this letter was then forwarded to the workers directly, those who were actually sought to get clarification about their status, which was unhealthy. I'm not going to waste time. I'm sure you've perused this letter, which has got certain promises that were made. But instead of any action coming from the officers concerned, certain leadership programs were introduced, which on the face of it were targeted to have a smooth removal of all the workers I've referred to, contained in the list that was applied to this honorable committee. So it was here that it was going for a systematic removal of these people. As you can see, these individuals, you see for how long they served, their contact numbers, everything was provided as per request that was made by us. But nothing happened until this program was then introduced of leadership, which excluded the people I referred to who kept on doing the work as if nothing had happened. And they were not satisfied about that aspect. Without taking much of your time, we were then approached as an office to render legal assistance. Of course, any reasonable attorney would tell them that we are not employees of PRASA, and as such, the relationship between you and Metro Rail is not governed by the Labor Relations Act, where you can simply go to the labor court and present your case of unfair treatment or dismissal, as the case may be. It was explained to them that the only thing they can assist you is to carry on with the negotiations, because already it started. So we couldn't charge them anything, as the court relevant would not be labor court. So there has been the life of negotiations, which I believe you do have in the various notes that were provided previously for abbreviation. That did not really help. Well, of course, I've referred to in those notes that duly requested by the various workers, certain meetings were held, and some of which I had to attend just to assist, but not as a legal representative. Because even here, gentlemen and ladies, sorry, we are not here to enforce any rights that is enshrined in any statute. Our presence here is not based on legislation, but it is based on what we feel and legitimate expectation. These people coming again have been promised that their situation will be attended to. as I say, we plan really mean to get this audience. It's had to take us some time and pay, but eventually, thank you very much. I'm sure the Secretariat is relieved that today at least it's the year. And the chairperson as well, I must be honest. I was doing something that under normal circumstances I would regard as unethical. But due to pressure that I experienced from these unfortunate individuals, I just had to overlook any principles as long as I felt that equity and people first was paramount. So having had those meetings, the first meeting we had, which I attended, I'm just not going to deal with other meetings that these individuals on their own held with their employers. It was organized, it was held in Durban in the Law Society Library, and thankfully Metro Rail had financed the hiring of the relevant hall and some refreshments for which the members, the delegates, were very much thankful, and they were looking forward that indeed something positive would come out of it. I referred that into the memorandum for the sake of time possible. And that meeting was to have a follow-up meeting where now certain things would be ironed out. I'm not going to bother you about that. But this is to show that indeed we did get some attention. But funny enough, when the meeting was scheduled to be held at Plaza offices in Devon, where we were invited, the very same delegation that had attended the meeting at the first year of the society did attend. And unfortunately on that occasion, not even the same person from Plaza was present, we were told that unfortunately we could not be told initially what the problem was, but it was adjourned to another date. That date came, the same delegation again came, and I was part of the delegation, just merely to assist, not as an ICA representative. In that meeting, it was made quite clear that the other members, actually there were two of you besides myself, were not welcomed to attend that meeting, but I was to talk to whoever was present. Of course, it was not, did not occur well, because really, just famous, why all of a sudden these people cannot run a team. But I had to do it for the sake of completeness. It was indicated, no, look here, these fellows were not advised. Of course, I'm going to read the letter, which will summarize almost the whole thing regarding the attitude of the Department of Transport. No, those people are not employed, and the chance to apply like any other person post will be made available. They must look at the press. Of course, they were completely correct. That I must say. Of course, we're not. Nor have we came to have been directly employed. Hence, we had to negotiate. Having done so, at some stage indeed, the advertisements were there, which were been told to expect. Applications were made by almost all these people, and we have been told that each would be considered on its own merits, but not going to be any wrong, to which we were heading, just to see that indeed would be accommodated by the Department of Transport. At some stage indeed, all the people I referred to in that list received SMS messages from Trust that they should present themselves at Hoy Park for fitness tests. They had to do some exercises and do what is normally done for such paramilitary organizations, running around the ground and all, doing all that. They did accede to that, and to which they were very much thankful that indeed the negotiations with the members of PRASA are bearing fruit. That hasn't happened thereafter. We got a call through Mr. the one who ought to have conducted this presentation. I just have come in because we might put it off, Mr. Lamine Fassett. He was in touch with the head office. Remember, he had some meeting with Mr. Matakata. At some stage, Mr. Borshoff, which I believe was with this transport, has cleared the process, also took part in those negotiations. at some stage it was said, no, look, these people must provide their CVs. Somebody from the head office will come to them and to collect. And indeed, the 500 strong members presented, which were kept at our office, are waiting the call that somebody would come and pick them. Which, I would say, was almost the third, not the fourth, legitimate expectation that indeed something was done about their life. But believe you me, this person did not even a single person of all the people has ever been employed by a person. So, that being the position, I told them that, well, that's the way the cookie crumbles. The matter cannot be taken further anymore. Just to throw some light, I'd just like to read, I'm not going to take much of your time, just to support the issue that the legality is referred to as not as if the office I represent was not aware of. Otherwise, had it not been for that, I would have gone the proper way. But as part of the service we render for the populace, most of you come from KZN, will know that the office I serve, it did so with diligence and with distinction, and for which we can stand anywhere we see that is well done. So we are trying to perpetuate that legacy. There's a letter we wrote to the Department of Transport on the 12th of July, 2011. I do not know whether members of this honorable committee have had the privilege of taking it. And there is a reply to that letter without taking much time, which we received dated the 29th of November 2011. I do not know which was the answer. I do have an extra copy, which we received from the Honorable Chief of Staff for the Minister of Transport. May I please send this in case some members might not have. I'm just trying to abbreviate. The reply which we got from the, of course, not surprising, and it was proper and justified, if indeed we're dealing with the matter on the ordinary legalistic fashion. But if we were to deal with this matter, bearing in mind the background I've just outlined, bearing in mind that most of the people in respect of whom we render the service are indigent, they can hardly afford, and some of them, as I said, have served, for instance, on my left, they served for 14 years. No benefits have accrued to him as they would for any person who is permanently employed. So without taking much of your time, if you look at this then, of course, there's nothing wrong with it. But it makes no sense, with due respect, if the matter was considered in the way and in the fashion that we sort of bring to the department. So it is for that reason, without taking much of your time, I realize that your schedule is very tight and you are dealing with matters of national interest. But equally so, this may appear to be, but not that serious. But we wish this committee, even if it does give us a reply today, to consider this and give the attention to the meeting. Thank you.
Thank you very much, thank you very much. Honorable members earlier, he is long overdue. Indeed, Carmela has just been on my neck on a regular basis. When I see a seven number, I just sometimes don't want to respond because I know it's him really, but for the issues of fertility and the issues of humanity, I think those are some of the issues that he was raising. Honorable Maswangani, Honorable Mapita, Honorable Mlaunzi,
I don't know. How do you say that?
It was a proper chaplain that we get on of the department and class. Before I get into within that letter that I never talked about, I only have the one and the letter to the minister. But we understand what is the response of the agency and the response of the department. Otherwise, I will speak of the president.
Thank you very much, Honorable Masondani. I think that has been one of the challenges that we're experiencing, that much as we thought that these were the only documents that actually would be coming from the employees. So it becomes a very difficult thing to can be able to further articulate or make an assessment as to how we can look into it. This is Honorable Masondani.
Now,
the way matters like that are mediated for resolution, I don't quite think it's through the portfolio committee platform. You can give a hearing, but with the final announcement, I think there should be other mechanisms. Also, I didn't quite, I know that there's been a lot of request for the presentation here, but also the matter looks, seems to me that it was a subcontractor with Metrorail. The numbers moved from 200 to 500. There's a letter that talks about a letter of 2011, speaks about representing $200. And the memorandum is moved from the 200 to 500. But I still ask the question, the matter of Metrorail, why, I don't know that the workers should know who they were in the relationship with. Were they in the relationship with Metrorail? Or Metrorail stroke Prasa and. It seems to be a cash or trade, which creates a problem for me. Why do they other bodies that have got no relationship with that relationship interest? Because you've got Metrorail security, like they have security in Cape Town, that are contracted by Metrorail for terms of the other stations or their network. They are, that is the way in which they enter into relationship and how they go to find ways of achieving the time. So, and that must be that body. Now, because once you bring other bodies, then the argument becomes defective in the argument. But if we wanted to create a big issue about the general view, right? So maybe let me just put this way, sir. I suggest that we should note this problem, that there is a problem, that there must be other information that we must receive from the Department of Transport that we have not received. That in the process going forward as a committee, we must also discuss this matter as to what is it that you may suggest as a way forward. And I must be quick to say we must represent the pro bono work does not necessarily suggest that you are not a legal representative of this work. And so if you going forward, either the another committee should hear this particular matter, not quite this committee. Because it is a matter of employee relationship issue. We are cited here by an accident of because Metro falls under us. But at the end of the day, we are not the body that can mediate for the resolution around that. Because we are also managed, or in fact, we are governed by various legislation. There's a big issue around this issue about the casual workers, from casual into that thing that Kosato was talking about, the new lighting and. In all this process, I don't know, I don't hear what has been the meaning. How did the union deal with this particular matter? Or whether workers were completely unionized, and if they were 14 years in the system, surely there should be some kind of relationship with the union in the sector. What has been the attempt, because they also have the muscle to deal with the employer around the different negotiations, irrespective of the legal arrangement. So in all, in this waffling that I am waffling about, I suggest that we ask that the other committee that deals with the labor matter hear this particular presentation, that
the labor side, but there will be more say about what is called the legitimate expectation, what does that mean in terms of law. So I would suggest that we do that, but from the attorney side, you can get the good kind of information. So that you can also hear from the Department of Transport what they are taking on the next step.
Thank you, Jason. Chair, I actually wanted to make a proposal and that the committee has to discuss and get all the supplementary documentation. So it seems that we've gone into discussion, but I think it's very important that we do not create expectations from that. That is the most important thing. But secondly, you know, I do understand where the point is coming from. We're sitting here with a situation where we can say that this is a labour issue. But on the other side, we're talking here about employees that it's not employees of Metro Rail, but it is contractors that can be attend a basis. So and from as far as the letters that I could see, we're talking here about a situation of number one, the employees, whether the subcontractors change, the employees stay the same for 14 years. So I think the issue that needs to be dealt with really from the way I see it, and not a labor issue, but why are we as government making use of labor talk or labor brokerage? That is the biggest problem. And I want to give you an example. I can take you to a factory now in Wikipedia that is German owned. Okay? And what they are doing is they are employing people. There is some guy that has been working there for 18 years and no benefit. They can't even buy a car. And it's a contractor that is making the money, but the employee is still getting, instead of a 12,000 rand per security guard, what is happening is the poor person is walking out with 1,600 rand a month, and it's the company is making the money and exploiting the people. Now, I think as a committee, we need to have discussions on whether we are going to allow in future to any governmental department any more labour brokers, because we will forever have this problem. So, Chair, if I can make a proposal, I would say that we should get all the rest of the documentation as well and make those copies available to us and then possibly look at how we can take it through to the department or the Department of Labour as well and see how we can assist, but also put a stop to labour brokers.
I like to compare myself with the leader, for how long was this matter? For an example, if you check in terms of the law, I'll start fighting an example. Like if you check a letter to the road patrol fund, it must be different in some terms and conditions that within this law, which in this year, you must report your letter. If you don't report this letter, I don't know how to put it. Because this one, I'm talking for correction. This letter, the letter which is returned by your office, stipulate that this thing happened after the lead was in industrial action was taken or problem. On the 3rd, April 2008. This is 2015. So that is my concern. And secondly, I think only Member Maramataka was correct, and only Member was correct, because now, for a notification of Shapuna, we do have temporary conditions in terms of your oral quality on that side. We don't have from the other side.
it might have happened that I was listening. There were lots of stakeholders involved. We don't have in our hands their responsibility on the family. It might have happened this letter, I mean this letter, okay, but was also taken to the department, you don't know their responsibility. It might have happened this matter, the import, you know what it was. If the way we deny, you don't know what was happening. Why is it that this matter was taken to CCMP? We don't know what was their response. If it was taken to CCMP. That's the thing. Because, you know, what is worrying me, in terms of the labor laws in this country, some of the things that are happening in terms of labor conditions, people they do have liberty to take that matter to CCMA. But now we are not sure whether we are taking there or not. So therefore, certainly I was going to strongly support the idea from them that we are prepared to assist, but let this matter be tabled. We recommend that this matter be tabled in a relevant way in the labor. For the community, so that they can help us and assist and assist. And also, what is really dangerous to me, you see, honorable Makata, you mustn't forget that some of the areas, which is like you talk about the issue, but when it gets into our interest, whereby it's a really important, we're very strongly about the issue of labor progress. It must seem to perceive. And if the issue of labor broadcast is our baby, obviously not our baby, but also we are the key players who are saying down about the labor broadcast. Now, no, I'm protected. Because of okay. Even there, there is a challenge. Baba is a leader of this group, as a person with a legal background. If you go to an employment, there are some challenges in that particular employment. You don't just go in an employment. Whether it's whatever, labor for whatever, the terms and conditions, we don't have those terms and conditions in our hands. It makes our case be very strong to say to success or to recommend that. That's of course what we take to us. But let this matter be taken to the relevant people so that they can assist me to check on the sites where it's supposed to be taken and where they are, people are specializing. That's okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, I think firstly we would request the law firm to give us more information that will be able to make us take a decision because we really don't have much information that can be able to make us think through and continue on the matter. But secondly, the department is here. I don't know if there's anything you want to raise on this matter.
Thanks once again, Chair. And we welcome the presentation by the law firm. But, Chair, I suppose all of us now, I think there's concurrence that this matter has went through a number of stages. We need some form of documentation that will allow process, I think, in our case, so that we are able to look at this matter and also whoever needs to respond in this case, make sure that and also how they can for us. I suppose the same sentiments that have been said by the chair about the need for more additional information. I suppose that we have to. Thank you.
thank you very much. From the committee side, we will not necessarily bring you back. We will try to gather as much information from yourself, from CASA, from the department, so that we can be able to have proper documentation and be able to, arising from this needed once you've got those documentation, be able to say this is the route to follow. But also at the same time, once we've got available documents, we will also be guided, as has been indicated here, that we refer the matter to the Portfolio Committee on Labour so that they can be able to assist taking the matter forward. But we're not barring you as the assistant to these employees, that you can take that route of making sure that you submit every information to the Portfolio Committee on Labour, so that they can be able to also start working on this matter while we will also be looking into the information that can be able to assist. So I think having said that, it definitely will be able to assist us to work. But I must also hasten to indicate that there is a letter here which is actually coming from the Minister's office, which is indicating a number of things. It will be sent to all of you. It's indicating a number of things as to, from how I read it, it tells you that the department is distancing itself because it says from the information that they have, there is no way where it is indicating that Brasa had appointed these people. From a number of things that they are indicating here, there is those particular situations that we find ourselves in. That is why it will be important for us to get all the information so that whilst we'll be seated, having had the presentation from the worker representative, then we can be able to take an informed position. But we're saying if we've got other information from yourself, forward it to us, it will assist us to speed up the matter. We'll go to PRASA, we'll also go to the department to look for information on this matter so that we can be able to work on it. We will refer it to the relevant portfolio committee, but we're not barring you from referring also to the relevant portfolio committee on labor. I think on that note, I don't know, sir, if you still have other issues.
No, thank you, Madam Chair, for the audience, generous audience we've had. But I wish to emphasize and underline that at no stage did we ever allege that the various employees were employed by PRASA. That I think I did allude to before I proceeded with my address. I wish to say that the only matter that made us to refer to the Department of Transport is that effectively, for all this period of time, these people rendered services to PRASA with the direct supervision of PRASA. So it is for that reason alone. So if indeed we are going to deal with this matter in the fashion in which some of the members have suggested, which is correct, it is on the face of it a labor dispute, which has got to be dealt with by way of CCMA as test input, and indeed, due to the fact that we cannot do that because there was no such reason. But this has been based on the policy that we should avoid situations where people are treated in this fashion, which I don't think is in line with the policy which our present government is pursuing, namely, but to keep that whatever we do, we will consider the people. If anybody can say to me, a pensioner's worked for a particular employer, 14 years, of course, two various behind the scenes employees, sorry, employers, this is proper. Nevertheless, I do accept the ruling that has been made. We are not expecting any legitimate expectation but because to highlight the branch that these people some in a perfect they've been reduced to 152 now, just correct the figure. Some eventually have been able to get them going somewhere. But others, it seems very weak, having served one employer through various employers for so long, whether they can easily be admitted. And but nevertheless, we will do as advised. If there's any additional information that we will have to, we will. And then, according to the use of this particular committee, it may be referred to the relevant committee. We thank you very much for the audience.
Thank you very much, Yamon Abuja. Unfortunately, if I do this to get school.
We offer to translate it and make it available to this particular people. Additional information that this honorable committee may desire. I do underline that we are not saying this committee should do things according to practical justice. To appeal, if there's anything that on human basis can be, of course, they can be. I'm not saying we don't have the extent of the labor court. As correctly pointed out by the minister, none have been directly employed. But we cannot overlook the fact that for these people who have raised for 3 years, for 14 years, they have been serving one employer through various employers. Thank you.
Thank you very much, honorable members. Let's go into the minutes of the last meeting. Your meeting
at this. Thank you very much.
Yes.
We are here to express our gratitude for this generous party. May we excuse you. Thank you. We'll do it.
Can you get the
thank you very much. Can we look at the minutes of the 18th of August?
Can I get your card or something?
And the minutes are any corrections? Nothing?
That's right there.
Can we go into page
our chairman teacher, in the discussion of the meeting, the summary of the summary. Okay. And I'm just asking this minister, the summary of the summary. Nothing arising from the minutes.
much. Honourable Member, there is an invitation from the Portfolio Committee on Public Accounts for tomorrow. They will be dealing with the outcomes of the Department of Transport. They have extended an invitation to members of this committee so that we can be able to acquaint ourselves with the issues that the Public Accounts Committee will be raising on this matter. So you are all invited to the meeting of the Portfolio Committee. Having said that, honourable members,
where is the meeting?
The email has been sent to all of us from the secretary, but the meeting is in March 7th. Okay. Would really appreciate if members can be able to go there. If you'd like to start, we should now start preparing for the principal act. Thank you very much. Honourable members, or honourable members.
Madam Chair, I will set up my public for tomorrow as a police portfolio committee for the
Thank you very much. Apology accepted. Now it is going to be on time, don't worry. Thank you very much, honorable member. We wish you such a honorable member, very important. Can you just 1 minute? It's something that you can go ahead and check. The House Chair has sent letters to all the chairpersons of the Portfolio Committee to say we will be coming overnight this month or next month. But he has since requested that we should identify collaboration with other Portfolio Committees. As yet, from myself, I have not identified the issues for collaboration. I will be guided by honorable members as to who do we think we can be able to go and do oversight with, like what?